3, 2, 1.
Here we go. Welcome everyone to the No Normal Show, brought to you by BPD. This is where we leave all things status quo, traditional, old school, and boring in the dust and celebrate the new, the powerful, the innovative, the bold, while delivering the future to healthcare's leading brands. I'm Stephanie Weirwill, EVP of Engagement, and I'm joined by the amazing Desiree Duncan, VP of Health, Equity, and Inclusion. Good morning, Des.
Good morning. Happy Monday. What's happening?
It is a Monday. Yes, we record these shows for better or for worse every Monday morning, bright and early. And we were saying Monday hits hard, doesn't it?
It truly does. It's like I didn't know it was coming. And then here we are, and I'm not prepared.
Right. It's like the holidays. We know it's coming, but we're never prepared. And we're also joined by Chris Bevelo, Chief Transformation Officer. Hello, Chris.
Hello. It is like a, what's the thing where you jump in ice water, a cold plunge? That's what it is. This is like a cold plunge for the brain. Rolling out of bed on a Monday and then hitting this podcast right away.
It's like, and yes, we're back.
And whoa, shake it off. Let's go.
Here we are. Let's go. Yes. Let's go. I do love a cold plunge, I have to say, but I don't know, this metaphorical one, not so exciting. So we have a lot to cover this week. There's a lot going on. First, we're going to hit a couple headlines. We're going to talk about a book that we're all reading, which is actually really interesting. It has some hot takes around Meta. And we're going to cover AB Webb's 2025 Emerging Tech Trend Report, which always pops at South by Southwest. It's such an exciting moment, and we've got a couple takeaways from that. And then we're going to get into our main topic of the week, which is, we're calling it Life in Moments. But it's this idea that moments are actually becoming more and more important, and the highlight reels, the short snippets of content, think the headlines, the TikTok moments, and those are capturing attention far more than the bigger, longer form content out there. So we're going to talk about what that means for brands and what that means for culture overall. A book that the three of us have been reading that has been taking the news headlines by storm, it is called Careless People. And Careless People is a tell-all book, kind of a whistleblower book, if you will. And it is about our friends at Meta, at Facebook, specifically Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. Careless People is by Sarah Wynne Williams, and the subtitle is A Cautionary Tale of Power, Greed, and Lost Idealism. So if that title and subtitle doesn't tell you what it's about, we certainly will. But we are all in the middle of it. I think Des is the furthest along, so we'll do our best to maybe not spoil too much, but I think we can't help but spoil a little bit. So I'll just stop there and say, Des, you look like you're raring to go on this one.
Piping hot tea all the way around. I'm here for it. It started off a little slow, and then I was like, what is this? It felt a little like low budget, like it was the book form of a Lifetime movie. However, yes, it got
nice.
Good.
That is so dead on.
Right? No, okay, I thought it was just me. I was like, why does this read really weirdly? But I mean, the only thing that I could just throughout, I've been listening to it. And the only thing I think about throughout this constantly is like, wow, did she not have to sign an NDA? Because she is sharing all the goods. But of course, there's been controversy around that. But curious your take, Chris.
I'm not as far along as you are. I'm on chapter 11, I think. But I just started getting to the part where the tea is all over the table. And I'm just going to say, like, I haven't even got to the, like, egregious things that I'm sure are coming, because we know a lot of them about Facebook from the whistleblower who came out a couple years ago. So we're gonna get a bunch on that, I assume. It's really right now, it's really not a good portrayal of Mark Zuckerberg. It's what you would expect in the worst case scenario, that he's kind of like a 5-year-old running around. He's clearly a brilliant guy. But also in his sensitivities and stuff like that, and his actions, his behavior, it's reinforcing kind of the worst thoughts there. But what I'm being taken aback by is the Sheryl Sandberg stuff. Given her, and I think stuff has come out. Look, I didn't read the book, Lean In. I am not, I'm not super familiar with all of her stuff, other than the book was really followed by a lot of women, because it supposedly, I think, was supposed to teach you how to like have it all, how to like the best way to move up in the corporate world, but still have family life and whatever. And this book like shatters that within like five pages of talking about it. Double standards, hypocrisy, just straight up BS. So it's very unflattering for Sheryl Sandberg, and I'm maybe 15 pages into the content on her. So I'll stop there. Stephanie.
Yeah, I'm not quite as far as you all, but you know, like you said, there has been whistleblowers before, specifically Frances Haugen, as you mentioned. So in some ways, this is not terribly new news. But what is new and different about this take is it is focused on policy and global policy. And so this person, their perspective is, it was kind of interesting hearing, you know, she really saw this opportunity for Facebook to take on public policy and really think about the global nature of what, you know, the company was doing. And she got a lot of pushback in the early days or even trying to get the job because the leaders at Facebook didn't even see or understand or realize like why that was going to be a thing. And so that was interesting, just like the lack of foresight just in the building of the business. You know, this is coming from that slant, which might even be more interesting now, given where we are in the world than the original whistleblower details.
Yeah, my last comment. It was really exciting just kind of hear like the opportunity that we had, like of shaping moments, movements, what have you. And it just reminded me of like some of the early organizing I did back in the day and just kind of hearing that told, but then looking at where it went is just so, so sad.
Yeah. Yeah, that made me think a little bit about, you know, where we are right now with the organizations that are being built. And of course, we've got our eye on AI and of course, I think have a better handle as a society on how that's going to shape absolutely everything. But at the same time, you think move fast, break things is still the mentality. It's still the Silicon Valley mentality. It's still the mentality of, you know, business building in that instance and tech building. And so I think this is a bit of a warning tale for our time as well.
Yes. A huge warning. I mean, I think a lot of people, Gen X, high, cynical, I haven't been on Facebook since 2018. So I've been out of Meta's world, no Instagram, no nothing, because I couldn't stand how they were using my data. So a lot of what I assumed about Facebook, kind of bad intent in many ways, I think will be proven out in this book. But also there was also always a feeling like this is a big company. They will do what's right in the end. They're smart people. And again, I'm only in chapter 11. But basically it's giving they don't know what the hell they're doing. They're very successful at the thing they're doing, but beyond the thing they're doing, they're really not considerate. They're careless. Hello, title. They're not considerate. They're not thinking, again, I'm not even into the heart of the book. So I think it's just going to show you can't trust these organizations. That shouldn't be a shock by now. But if you're trusting Meta to do what's right by the world, maybe you're going to be surprised by the book. We'll just leave the litigation potential right there.
Yes, yes. That. Okay, so I'll wrap it up with that. And you know, if you're listening, go read the book. Tell us what you thought. We would love to hear it. It would be interesting. Given that, as advertisers, you know, Facebook is a huge part of our lives, and we make these big decisions based on what Facebook does. But yes, there is litigation. So Facebook wanted really badly to stop the book, stop it coming out, stop the promotion of it. Actually, the day that it came out, the leaders at Facebook won a litigation so that it actually says that the book can no longer be promoted specifically by the author. And then there was a lot of follow-ups done with book critics to try to pull it back. So I think that tells you something there. But anyway, we'll just leave that there. And as we finish it, maybe we'll recap. Down the road. One more quick thing I'd love to hear from you both about, Des and Chris. So we've been talking a lot about White Lotus along the way this year. I missed last night's episode, but you all caught it. And I hear there was tea there too.
Yeah, things happened. Things occurred. Don't want to spoil it for those that haven't watched it yet or haven't caught up, but it there was a meme that I saw of the, what's his name? Michael White? Nope, that's not his name.
Mike but White. Yeah.
Mike White, okay.
Yeah,
and how he just like will write the randomest thing, will share the randomest storyline, and it just all in the haps of making us think about our role in society and how maybe we're each of them. It was a really interesting takeaway. Chris, what'd you think about the episode?
That is not a good quote to pull out after last night's episode. I sure hope we are not.
And not about each the episode, them. But okay. About the show and the themes of the show okay. in general. Not
well,
that one.
The episode is part of a larger theme. We cannot talk about it. We shall not talk about it. We will not talk about it. We'll wait to the end of the season to recap our White Lotus thoughts. How about that? I think there's how many more episodes? Two or three, maybe?
I don't know.
Not many.
Just be one, maybe two.
No.
April 6th is the finale.
Okay. So we got two left.
Two left.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. So let's move on to, we've got a couple, actually several headlines. Like I said, lots going on recently. I'm going to turn this over to you, Chris. I think you have a headline and a shout out. And then we'll get into our bigger topics.
Yeah. So last week we did an episode on generations, specifically Generation X. And I shouted out my friend, Alan Shoebridge, who is a senior executive at Providence, because I know that Alan loves Gen X. And I think I might have known he wrote a book, but I didn't know the title, which we found out when we posted the pod on LinkedIn, because his co-author jumped in and said, hey, actually, because we kind of talked about how there's not a lot that digs into Gen X, particularly Gen X's role in healthcare. And the turns out Alan actually is a co-author of this book, but his co-author, Dean Browell, jumped and said, actually, there is a great book on this. And it's called Don't You Forget About Gen X, One Generation's Crucial Role in Healthcare, which was almost exactly some of the stuff we were saying. So Dan Myers, by the way, is the third author. So to give credit to Alan, Dan, and Dean, I have not read the book. I don't remember seeing that title, but obviously that's really close to what we were talking about. We even made fun of the Simple Minds song. So maybe people should go read that and they will get the in-depth take that we were unable to find when we look for it. So it's great that there's a resource out there. So there you go.
I'm excited to read it.
Awesome. Okay, one more headline. I think back to you again, Chris. So we've been covering policy quite a bit on this show, maybe every week in January and February, because there's so much moving and so much changing. And so because of that, we have taken on a new way to cover that goes even beyond this show. So what is that, Chris? What does that look like?
That is called Policy ICU. So what we've done is, we might have mentioned this before, I can't remember, but the whirlwind that has been the last, well, I guess now a couple months coming out of DC in all ways feels so similar to some of us as this time, actually almost exactly 4 years ago in 2020, when COVID hit, and just the tsunami of news, the speed at which things were changing and happening, the import of the things that were changing and happening. And there's been a lot of that coming out of DC. This is related to the new administration, related to healthcare. And so we've gotten a lot of clients who have asked, you know, like, hey, what are your sources for this? Can you help us with this? So we pulled together a website that essentially is not just a curation of what's happening, because stuff happens literally every day. There are headlines every day. So you imagine an executive order is released related to healthcare. That's big news. How people respond to it is news. Lawsuits, court decisions, what health systems are doing, what the CMS is doing. Like, it just goes on and on and on. We imagine this will go on for the rest of this year, hopefully not longer, but it could go longer. And so we've pulled together a site that curates all of this with our take on it related to our clientele, which are primarily health systems. So when cuts are announced at the VHA, for example, we have a blog post about, hey, That's obviously not a good thing if you're in the VHA, if you work there, if you are a patient there. But for other health systems, they need to think about this too, because that means vets aren't going to have the resources they had before, and they may be using private healthcare, public healthcare, whatever you want to call it, outside the VHA. And what does that mean for you, and how do you need to accommodate that? So we have blog posts in there. We have three or four things that post every day. We have an AMA section, so you can ask us anonymous questions and we'll post those and answer those. We're going to try to have biweekly phone conversations with whoever wants to get on the phone and talk through what's happening. So all of this is available. It is password protected. It's a secure site, so you can go in there and see things. If you would like access to it, there's no cost. What you need to do is just email us at nonormal@bpdhealthcare.com, and we will send you the link for you to register. You just have to give your name and company and your email address, and then we approve you, because we really only want folks in healthcare in this forum, and then we'll get you right in there, and you can have access every day to what's happening, but not just what's happening, kind of our point of view on it and the potential implications. Policy, ICU. There you go.
Yay. Yay. I think this is just going to be so valuable, Chris, and I'm so excited about it. I'm excited to keep up with Policy ICU as well. And I know we'll be talking about several of those things along the way. But perhaps one of our themes from our next headline and our spotlight topic today is just the rapid pace of change. So as you pointed out, you know, policy is changing so quickly now. And so Policy ICU lets us catch up on it and help everybody else keep up on it, so we don't have to wait every week or month or whatever. So super exciting. One last headline here. So it's always an exciting moment for me. It's like Christmas morning when South by Southwest happens, and Amy Webb from the Future Today Institute, which is now the Future Today Strategy Group, she does her big keynote speech. And this year at South by, which I think was a week and a half ago-ish, she launched her 2025 Emerging Tech Trend Report. And this thing is a monster. This thing is like 100 pages usually. It's more than a bedtime read. It is more than a novel. It's just so dense and so interesting. And there's so many trends in there. And I always keep it in my back pocket throughout the entire year and kind of refer to it. So we all three took a peek at this, and specifically her YouTube video, which you can see it is live. She live streams her talk every year for free and highlights all of the changes happening. So we all did a bit of a dive into this, and no surprises. It's a lot about AI and the future of AI, but it's also about the future of AI meets biology, generative biology, synthetic biology, and quite a lot that's applicable both to marketing and healthcare. And I think one of the interesting things that she called out, again, back to that point about change, she says, change is happening in minutes now. Every single time you turn around, there's a policy update, there is a tech update, and that's kind of a new thing that she's seeing. So I want to hear either Des or Chris, as you all took a look at this, did you have any burning thoughts on it?
Yeah, I mean, just the living intelligence. I'm very excited about it. I've been a little, I don't know, kind of not afraid, but staying back. But like, for example, Ray-Ban's Meta glasses, I've been wanting them for a while, but also given our conversation earlier, I don't know how much of my data, like actual physical data, that I want Meta to have. But that idea of everything kind of connecting. And then the other piece was around the predicting behavior and just how we can really create engagement and ideas based off of kind of predictive nodes around, you know, what folks historically have done, might do, what have you, and just kind of coming up with ideas around that. But yes, it was very dense. It was like 1,000 slides, a lot of good information, a lot of it over my head. But excited for the future, but also deeply terrified as to what this can mean in not even just 5 years from now, but almost just 5 minutes. Chris, what were your thoughts?
I have not dug into the 1,000 piece.
What? You didn't read 1,000 pages over the weekend, Chris?
I did not do that. It's on my to-do list, which means who knows. I may have to just like look at the summary. I'll feed it into AI and get a summary. How about that? How about that go. For a meta, another use of the word meta. That's all I got. I got nothing. I got nothing on that other than it sounds super interesting and she's incredibly bright and smart. So what she says, I pay attention to. So maybe she needs to say it in less than 1,000 slides. But other than that, I will give it a shot.
That's a perfect segue for our bigger topic, actually. Yes, I think, yeah, let's just jump right. And I might refer back to Amy Webb a few times in this topic, too, because I think that some of the things that she shared in her talk are very applicable to our main topic. So our main topic is we're calling it life in moments. But there was this really interesting article, Chris, that I think you actually texted it to me a week ago or so. And you were like, this is so interesting. And so we wanted to talk about it because there's some really bigger applications for media, for marketing, for just, I don't know, societal and cultural change. So the article is called The Age of Consuming Sports in Bite-Sized Moments. And really the key piece here is that we're not tuned in for the games. We're not tuned in for the long form content, right? We don't have the time. To Chris's point, we're not reading 1,000-page tech trend reports. We want to get them summarized and get the take. And so it kind of talks about what it looks like to be in an age of moments, in an age of highlight reels instead of the bigger event. So Chris, if you want to set this up and maybe tell us how you found it, what it meant to you, how you've been seeing this trend in your own life and then we can tear it apart.
Yeah. And I will say that knowing that if I had a nickname, it would be the old man in the long form content, because I feel like I'm the king of long form content. I can't write anything short. I do like 1,000-page things. I have a take on why books are surviving and may die off on that a little bit. But yeah, so that's just my caveat. Yet this article, which by the way, is by Brian Phillips and is on The Ringer. If you're not familiar with The Ringer, it's basically a sports pop culture website, lots of podcasts, that kind of thing. And Stephanie set it up well, but I think what's interesting about it is kind of the turn it takes. So it's essentially talking about something that's been discussed for a while now and something I realized a few years ago. If you ask me what my favorite sport is, I would say the NBA. I follow it regularly. I know all of the takes. I know all of the storylines. I read the box scores. I'm into all the drama and I never watch a game. I mean, never. My team is the Timberwolves. If I'm at a Buffalo Wild Wing with friends and it's on, I'll watch. And in the playoffs, if they go far, I'll watch. I know there are a lot of people that still watch sports. However, the point here is I don't need to watch the game to actually enjoy the sport. And that is one reason people are saying why the NBA ratings are dropping like a stone, right? They're really going down. It's because people aren't watching. So the author tries to take a positive spin. So he's saying, look, this is more than just, he calls it, quote, irrefutable evidence that the internet drove a monster truck through the plate glass of our brains, meaning our attention spans are just like gone. We have no attention span. We're addicted to our devices. We want to consume everything. That's the, Stephanie, you'll talk about fear of missing everything, right? Or anything instead of fear of missing out. All those are true. But what he's saying is there's something more going on here, right? Because he talks about, it's not just that people are only consuming in teeny tiny bits anymore. Like all I need to see is the highlight of the dunk. And before he said like, that was just like a scene out of the movie and you didn't know the whole movie. So who cares about that scene? He's like, now the dunk is the movie, right? And he's talking about it in terms of, if that's true, then why are people playing fantasy league where they are general managers, where you basically have to have like an MBA to really do well? So you have to go in depth to do this stuff. So what's that about? Like, that's the opposite of just like, I just want to see the dunk, right? So his point, his turn is that this is really about moments or any kind of interaction that is shareable, right? So he's talking about it's the power of, it's really hard to do anything with a 2-hour basketball game with people unless you're physically with them, which is less and less the case, right? So he says the advantage of the moment may be less that it's short and more that you can do something with it, share it, memeify it, add a caption to it. As fans, we're always looking for excitement, more beauty, and less boredom. And a great moment certainly gives that to us, but maybe a great moment can also give us a little of what athletes get every time they play in a game. It gives us something to do. So that to me was, that's the build onto the kind of thing that people have been talking about for a while now, which is like nobody's watching, nobody's really watching sports. And if they are, like I've been watching the basketball games for the last weekend for the NCAA tournament, and I'm always doing something else. But a lot of what I'm doing is talking to my friends about a play, or I'm sharing a clip of a play. And so is that necessarily a bad thing? He's like, I'm an optimist. I'm going to assume this is a deeper engagement with sports, not a bad thing. But then he does say like, now, I don't know what that means for outside of sports. And he just says, I'm not even going to go there, right? It's not necessarily a good thing for everything. So that's the setup.
Yeah. He brings up a really interesting point, and honestly, it reminds me of like the early days of Twitter and live tweeting, and how I would be on Twitter and I would start to see a bunch of engagement about like maybe it was an award show. This was mostly like in Black Twitter, so it was either like Scandal, Empire, or the BET Music Awards, and just going completely in on that. But in a way, it made me feel like, oh, I want to be a part of the conversation. I want to be in relationship. And then you look at it today and like, yes, we are second screening it, sometimes even third screening it, but you're building a relationship with it. And so outside of sports, it reminds me of like fan fiction, where you get so into it that you kind of build worlds and like continue the conversation beyond the books, beyond the movies or what have you. But I know, Stephanie, you have some thoughts as well.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And I think building on that, it's interesting because, you know, now we've seen this trajectory of, to your point, the beginning days of live tweeting and then the second screening, the third screening. And I would say like now it's almost like the first screen is gone and we're just on the fourth screen, if you will. And sometimes that looks like just, you know, catching the highlights, like Chris mentioned in sports. Sometimes I think it looks like just catching a headline and repeating that headline. And, you know, sometimes it looks like just catching the TikTok video of the thing, right? Like, what's that viral moment happening? You didn't see maybe the episode or whatever it was, but you saw the TikToks. The TikToks, that makes me sound really old. You saw the TikToks. You saw what was happening on the talk. and you shared that, right? And so to me, like, I think about what's the underlying reason for this? And I think it is, I'm calling it the revenge of the attention economy. But, you know, I used to quote those stats about every 60 seconds, there's, I don't know what it was, 500,000 new videos created on YouTube or something. I mean, that was like 7 years ago. Now we just have this massive amount of constant flow of data, constant stream of content in front of us. And I don't know about you all, but I feel like almost anxiety around trying to catch all the things, trying to keep up with stuff, to the point, Amy Webb made this point. She was the one that coined that phrase. She said, "This no longer FOMO, it's FOMA. We have shifted from the fear of missing out to the fear of missing anything." And so it's just like there's just so much happening. You don't have time to watch the game. You don't have time to read the 1,000-page report. You just want that bite-sized summary, and then you're going to move that forward in whatever way you can and maybe deep dive on that, like Chris mentioned. So I think that's a huge societal change that happened. And I love that. I don't know what was that you said, Chris, about the dumpster truck to our brain? What was that phrase?
The dumpster truck to our brain. Did I say
you
that?
You said something about how there's been like a dumpster truck through the plate glass of our attention span in our brain.
A monster truck.
The monster
smashing
truck.
Through. Monster. And that was not me. That was the author of the article who said that. Yes. Yes, that's what it is like. That's exactly it. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I was having a conversation with my hairstylist the other week, and she was saying, like, she's like, I don't even have the attention span anymore to watch an episode, a TV episode. Like, it's just this constant stream of content. Our attention span has gone from the 6 seconds of the goldfish, I feel like, down to 2 seconds. And because of that, we're just looking for the bite-sized piece. So that's my cultural take. Maybe I'll come back and share what I think it means for marketing, but how does that sit with you all?
Yeah, I mean, it's why a SNL is still relevant these 50 years later, especially when people aren't watching the full like 90 minutes of it. Like, who's got time? I'm out here in the streets. But you see that luckily they have chopped up all of the different skits and clips and uploaded them to their YouTube channel, you know, starting, I don't know, over a decade ago. And then you can see all the pieces without having to drag through some of the worse skits, the less funny skits. And then on top of that, to your point about like, I can't, like at home, I can't just sit and watch. Like, I'm on my phone and I'm like, oh, I'm disgusted with myself. But it's one of the main reasons why I am all about going to the movie theater and that experience so that I can actually focus. Because if I have my phone out, you know, Nancy Negative over here is going to call the ushers on me and get me booted out. And so I do have to make sure that my phone is off and like be in the moment. Cause I find myself always trying to find those opportunities to be in the moment because so much just takes me out of it. And I'm just like completely distracted.
Yeah, it's why I don't go to movies anymore, though, because Des, most people don't follow that, and they do act it's like it's their living room, and I'm like, no, like you're breaking what makes this great. It is the hot take I was going to say on books. Reading a physical book may be the last medium. I suppose you could throw magazines and newspapers if they even survive. You cannot read a book and have a second screen. You can maybe listen to some music. But it's different than even listening to a book. I've caught myself listening to a book on tape and then by the way, we have a lot of the tech companies that we mentioned earlier to thank for this addiction. That is not coincidental. That is not societal. That is an intentional tapping into the part of your brain that is tied to addiction. You are literally just hoping for the next thing, right? And so try to like listen to a book and then also go on your phone. I've actually caught myself like listening to a book and then listening to a video accidentally and going, what in the world am I doing? You can't do it with I defy anybody to read a book and also have another screen and look at them both and get anything out of it. So to me, Des, I don't even have movies anymore. It's just that's the only thing left to have for that moment.
It also depends on what movie that you're going to. It sounds like you're going to like a Regal and it's full of like people and children. I go to just indies so that
it's usually filled with people. It's a good point. Yeah.
No, Nick, Chris, you are the Nancy Negative in that scenario, it sounds like.
What do you mean? Yes. I mean, that's why I don't even go anymore, because it's not one or two people. It's the whole audience. So it's just it destroys what Des is talking about.
Yeah.
And I don't know. People just don't know how to not do it. And I almost don't blame them because, again, like there's some pretty big companies who, by the way, as we learn in the book, mm-hmm. and we already knew this, if you watch some documentaries on it, do not let their kids have smartphones or go on social media because they know the addictive nature of it. The very people that are putting these products out. So, yeah.
And that everything that they do from a policy standpoint, from what allegedly they were trying to do altruistically, quote unquote, was all in the name of getting more people. How can we get more people addicted to this? And I don't know, I'm excited to see what more comes of that and just how like, shut it all down.
Well, we know that controversy, you know, scandal, negativity, anger, like all that stuff drives people to pay attention, right? It's like the people rubbernecking driving by a car accident. They know that. And so they feed more of it. They feed you more stuff to get you riled up, to keep you engaged.
Yeah. So to that, I've been thinking a lot about how in this environment, as a brand, do you play the game because you have to play the game? Or do you say, how do we operate in this environment where that's the expectation, but are we just going to feed more into this? Are we just going to contribute to it? So I'm going to lay out some, I don't know, I think interesting media scenarios or media changes. And then I want to come back to that point of like, as a brand, how do you play into this in the right way? But then also, where do you maybe take a backseat in some areas? So there was a really interesting report that came out in January by a research firm out of the UK called Magic Numbers. And they did a study in partnership with Work. And they shared some really interesting media changes that play exactly into this trend. So I love one of the headlines they called out, which is big ads on big channels are replaced by a lot of littles. We all know linear TV impressions are down. That's not new news, right? Especially for younger audience. In fact, it's down by 73% in the last 10 years. But what I thought was really interesting was they broke up all these little teeny tiny time block places and actually kind of categorized it in new ways that I hadn't seen before. So we're spending our time in channels such as traditional social, alt social. So think like Discord or maybe even Reddit, podcast, niche email. I hadn't thought about niche email as a channel, communities, news sites, niche sites, AI apps, search engine, and then owned sites, which was a pretty general category, which included things like brand sites and more. And there was more than that, but just they broke down like the media time, of course, has been increasing, but it's gotten more and more fragmented. And the way it's gotten more fragmented is with these bite-sized pieces. So they studied holiday campaigns from last year, from December 2024. And what they found was that headline, big ads on big channels are replaced by a lot of littles. So instead of budgets going towards, here's my 60-second or 90-second anthem spot, you know, it is, here's my 100 pieces of super bite-sized content. I've heard this referred to before as nonlinear narratives, but like all the little teeny tiny pieces that you're putting out and how you're stitching them together, because you're not going to expect somebody to necessarily lean into your long form content. Although I don't want this to sound like long form is dead. I think you still need that game that, you know, that your biggest fans watched in order to get those highlight reels. But I thought that was kind of interesting. And I don't know if you all are seeing that in your brand work, but I thought it was a really big shift of media given this cultural change.
Yeah, I mean, starting after the election, the conversations around kind of going to these personalized areas where people are gathering. So yes, a meta is a place where people, like, we've talked about how we need to go where people are. And yes, all of them are on these channels. However, it's super duper saturated, right? But then if you really want to have resonance, it's like show up where a person is geeking out, where a person is really actually paying attention and not just scrolling. They're actually paying attention to the conversation. As you would see in the subreddits and the discords and what have you, you're there for that thing. But then also making sure that you tie it in to that thing. You don't want to just have some random like ad or just some completely off topic thing show up. You need to embed it into the conversation. But, you know, that takes so much more work. Granted, though, we have some AI, some of what we saw in that deep dive, the trends report that we can use to help predict some of that stuff. But the more that we can actually make something relevant to where a person is and where they're engaging, the better. I don't know, Chris, have you seen some things?
Yeah, it makes me think of a couple things. Like, we've been talking about engagement forever. I don't know, a decade at least, and the importance of engagement. And this just tells me that engagement's even more important, right? Because engagement was always one of the best ways to build and strengthen a relationship to a brand. If you can engage somebody, that tie is much stronger than just an impression. Well, now you've got audiences that want to engage. So it's even more important that you are engaging with them in the way that they want, where they want. And that may be in the moments like we're talking about. But I think there's also kind of like, it's like a double-edged sword, because I don't think engagement is always positive. And it will not always be in your control. So of course you want to generate, to Des's point, as Stephanie said earlier, the right engagement moments, but there's going to be engagement that happens whether you like it or not. And I think a great example of this is the phenomenon when somebody changes their logo. This gets into a different trend, which I've dubbed the 2 cent nation. We've become the 2 cent nation. Everybody wants to give their 2 cents because they can, so they will. And I think even worse than that is people think that their opinions are the same and equal to everybody else's opinion because they have one, whether it's based in accuracy or it's informed or it's coherent. But if you change your logo, all of a sudden everybody's like a experienced designer and they got something to say about the color of orange that you used. And I still can't get over everybody's anger at the Tropicana logo. Like, seriously, like, we have too much time on our hands. But that's going to happen in all kinds of ways to you. So how do you navigate that, right? Like, my advice would be just like, let it happen. Like, people are going to say, no matter what you do, people are going to say something. So you have to be okay with that, or you're not going to do anything. But also nurture the positive. How do you have fun of it? Some brands have fun with that kind of stuff. And then also, nurturing the positive. And then I'll just reinforce one more time what Stephanie, what you said. I think depending on the brand and the situation, it's probably moving more to quantity over depth, moments over, you know, long books. However, don't just go with headlines and tweets, right? You can't be all surface level. There are brands, particularly our clientele, that are built in large part on expertise. And you can't be an expert with tweets and headlines only. You have to have long form. You have to have deeper dives. No matter how we're thinking about this, your true fans will want more. So the fan fiction doesn't happen without the fiction in the first place. Like you said earlier, the highlight of the dunk doesn't happen without the game in which nobody's going to share dunks of somebody alone in a gym dunking. Nobody cares, right? So even there, it's the same moment. You got to have the content in the first place. So you can't abandon that. And that's not just me, old guy. And this feels like a myth, like the old man in the sea, the old man and the long form content. That's not just because I want it. I think that's true generationally. So that's what I have to add to that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you need your entire ecosystem, but you can't forget about the moments. And I think it's just so easy to be like, okay, we made our campaign and now we're done. Great. End of day, walk away. And it's like, no, what are all your many, many millions, probably even millions of moments around that? And the last thing I'll say is just, here's my little cautionary tale. I think it's just to your point about the 2 cent nation, Chris, like, I don't know. That is just, it's just driving me up the wall these days. Just the amount of hot opinions online. And, you know, we always run to the comments, right? You like break your hip running to the comment section to see what people are saying. And I think as brands, that just makes our jobs way, way, way harder because you have to have the hottest, boldest, most crazy take to even break through. And in healthcare, like that's really not the job. We oftentimes don't want to have that because we're, to your point, experts. So I think about like a good example. We talked about Duolingo the owl and his death. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous, but it's an example of like that brand. That was something that they needed to do to break through this clutter. And my caution is, how much do we really want to play the game? Because we could turn into the, you know, what's happening in the media, which is just like the headlines get more and more ridiculous in order to get those clicks. And, you know, it's just the revenge of the attention economy is what I keep going back to, the revenge of the 2 cent nation. So I think that's the marketer's job, is you want to have the boldest, most cut through, most breakthrough, most interesting, most attention grabbing message that still remains true to who you are at your heart. And therein lies the magic of the job, I think. So that's my last point here. But any last quick takes before we wrap up?
Watch White Lotus. Better watch
it. That's my homework. So for all of you listening, thank you so much for joining. We would love it if you subscribe to the newsletter, the No Normal Rewind, which is where we share all of this discussion and more so you can catch up on what happened this week. And we would love to hear from you. So if you have anything you'd like us to cover on future episodes, shoot us an email at nonormal@bpd.com and we'll feature your question in a future episode. Also, if you want to join us in Policy ICU, like we talked about earlier, and keep up what's happening in the policy world, you can shoot us an email or join in at bpdhealthcare.com. And as always, make sure you share the show with friends and colleagues. We love that. And until next time, don't be satisfied with the normal. Push the no normal, and we'll talk to you next week.
3, 2, 1.